This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Robert Lewis was running on a dirt track in the hills above Berkeley, California, where every time he finished a lap, he could see clear across the water to San Francisco.
And so I've finished my jog, and I'm starting to walk back. And as I'm walking, I think waiting for the light, I pull out my phone and check my email. And I see I have this email from, it says, Public Records.
Robert is a reporter with the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley. And this email from the Attorney General of California, it isn't just a friendly follow-up about some government documents they sent him.
The subject line of this email is Notice of Inadvertent Release of Department of Justice Confidential Information and Request for Destruction of Information.
Request for Destruction of Information.
And then I get to the bottom of the first page, and it says, you are hereby on notice that the unauthorized receipt or possession, and they've put or possession in italics, of a record from the department's ACHS or information obtained from such a record is a misdemeanor. They're basically saying you are committing a crime by having these records. And then it goes on to say, if you do not destroy them, we will take legal action.
So let me get this straight. The state is threatening to prosecute you for having a document that the state sent you in the first place. How did you feel when you read that?
I mean, I'm angry. I was angry when I got this. I think this is counter to our First Amendment. I think this is counter to the principles of free press. I'm stunned, especially when you understand what these records actually are.
The records are a list of current, former, and aspiring police officers in California who've been convicted of breaking the law cops are supposed to enforce. There were nearly 12,000 names, each listed next to a crime, from disorderly conduct to sexual assault to murder. So why did the state want Robert to destroy the list?
Everything on here, every name on here, is someone who has been convicted of a crime. And court records are public. Those are open.
Is it because these are police officers?
I don't know. It certainly seems suspicious.
It seems like one more example of a kind of special treatment for police that happens all over the country, where public employees who can legally take a member of the public's life get to keep their worst behavior private. Today, we're going to dig into how all kinds of police misconduct are kept secret and what happens when the secrets get out. So, essentially, you have a list of cops who have committed crimes, and you have the Attorney General implying that he's going to prosecute you unless you destroy the list. Do you destroy the list?
No, I didn't destroy the list.
So what did you do?
I mean, I started reporting.
So where is the courthouse from here?
It's just up ahead. It's a couple blocks.
This is where Reveal Stan Alcorn joined Robert at San Francisco's Hall of Justice.
Yeah, this is the Hall of Justice. It's one of the courthouses in the city.
We went to the courthouse because for each entry on Robert's list, all we had was a name, a crime, and a date. And we wanted the whole story.
I knew that the only way to get this information was going to be to physically go to the courthouse and pull these files.
Let's pull some files. So it's 10:15.
Okay.
I didn't realize how much work this was going to be.
So where are we going first?
We're going to go to room 101. It's the clerk's office.
This clerk's office in a courthouse in the middle of San Francisco, like a mile from Google. It doesn't have a single computer. Instead,
there's these blue binders with like the dot matrix printer paper, you know, they're kind of talking about with the like little holes on the side.
Just to make sure I understand, what exactly is in this giant blue book?
So basically, this is everyone with a last name starting with G.
So you open this huge binder.
And you flip through and you find the row that has your person's name and the case number.
And then you take that case number and you get in line to see one of the clerks.
Let's see, I have a 2012 sentencing. I have a 2010 sentencing.
Well, I guess you fill out a request form.
Yeah.
Sometimes a clerk gets you all the court documents you need and lets you scan them right then. Other times, you just have to fill out these forms requesting them to look for the files.
So 1 hour later, you're leaving, having made requests
one,
at least for
2, 10, 11.
11 requests in, just 1,000 more to go.
Yeah. Yeah, making real progress.
This sounds so tedious. Like, it feels like you're on a beach full of sand and you're looking for one little grain. And then you can only look at it for a minute and then you got to put it back.
And we were trying to do that for more than 1,000 names in like 100 different courthouses.
And we realized pretty quickly that we couldn't do it by ourselves. So we reached out to three major newspaper chains around the state.
McClatchy, the USA Today papers, and the Media News Group. Reporters from all these newspapers and also the nonprofit Voice of San Diego, they all went to their local courthouses.
I'm outside the Rancho Cucamonga courthouse.
It's a pretty quiet day today in the courthouse, fortunately. I've got a list of about 60 names. I'm going to go in here and pull as many files as I can.
But there still weren't enough reporters. So we had these two graduate students, Laurence Dussault and Katie Rouche, who drove to courthouses all around the rural Central Valley.
So we are approaching the desert of Mojave. We're about 9 minutes out, 7 miles.
And they ran into all sorts of hurdles. There are clerks pulling documents out of files. Some cases...
Hi, Katrina.
Clerks said were just gone.
So we requested 27, but you said 12 were available. Does that mean that the other 15 were destroyed?
We found hundreds of case files across the state were destroyed. And it seems that some of these places are, you know, the day that they can technically by law shred a file, they are.
Oh, wow. So those, it's not like those 15 are archived somewhere. Those 15 are just destroyed.
So after 6 months of reporting on all the cases where you could find records, what did you find?
Well, we ultimately were able to pull about 1,000 case files, and we found about 630 current and former law enforcement officers convicted of a crime in the last decade.
And another way to think about that number, on average, more than once a week, a current or former cop in California is convicted of a crime.
And it's a undercount. I mean, the truth of the matter is we found the tip of the iceberg. You know, we found murders, we found vehicular manslaughter, we found sexual assaults, we found child pornography. I mean, you sort of pick a crime and chances are good we found a case file with that.
But there were these two kinds of crimes that stood out.
DUI and driving offenses were by far the biggest type of crime that we found. After DUI, it was domestic violence.
Domestic violence among police officers is a known problem. It's been in the national news every few years for decades, like this one notorious case that was on 60 Minutes.
It all began in the Los Angeles suburb of Glendale, California, in 1992. This woman's sister, 26-year-old Melba Ramos, had been gunned down by her husband, an officer in the Los Angeles Police Department.
After this officer, Victor Ramos, murdered his wife, it came out that he'd previously beaten her and threatened her with a gun. And the cops who showed up hadn't even arrested him.
Fact is, thanks to his being a police officer, nothing much happened to him at all.
Law enforcement's come a long way in terms of how it deals with domestic violence. That's according to every expert we talk to. There's a federal law now that says if you're convicted of domestic violence, you cannot own a gun, even if you're a cop. And the cops who showed up on our list, all of them were arrested by other cops and convicted, which looks like the system working. But when we took a closer look at some of these cases, we found that system has some loopholes.
This is going to be number 3 on the size?
I think so.
Ana Marquez cuts hair in a strip mall. She's got her initials in bright pink in the window. AM Salon.
Was it always just AM Salon, or did it have
no.
a different...
It used to be his name and my name.
Canty Marquez.
Canty and Marquez.
The Canty is Tony Canty. He was a police officer with the Marina Police Department and was also Anna's boyfriend. But over time, Anna says she started to feel more like his servant.
I could never go out with friends. Like, never. And then I was telling him, oh, they invite me to a wedding or a quinceañera. And then he was saying, what are you talking about? I don't want to be sitting there next to a bunch of Mexicans. Are you kidding me?
The night that led to Tony's criminal conviction, Anna was in bed. And Tony was yelling at her, according to her youngest daughter, Ashley.
It was one of the scariest nights.
Ashley watched as her older sister, Diana, tried to get past Tony to their mom's bedside.
She was like, okay, I just need to get to my mom. Like, my main concern was checking that my mom was okay.
Diana is this 100-pound teenage ballet dancer. Tony is this big dude. He weighs 230 pounds.
She would try to push him away and, like, go around him, but obviously, like, there was nothing she could do about it.
And that's when he grabbed me by the neck and pushed me all the way into a wall and started choking me.
Diana remembers him holding her to the wall by her throat for a full minute. Once he let go, Diana called the police. Officers came and took a report, and then they left.
And I remember that night was so scary because he was not arrested. So we were just like terrified that he would do something in my sleep. Terrified.
One reason Diana says she was scared was that Tony, although he'd recently retired from the police department, he still had a bunch of guns.
I remember one of them was on his nightstand.
So all this, when he's choking you, there's a firearm within, I don't know, 10 feet.
Yeah, he could just take two steps and grab the gun.
Tony didn't return my calls, but he told another reporter this wasn't domestic violence. Still, he was eventually charged with battery, negligently storing a firearm, and child endangerment, which would have outlawed him from keeping those guns. But instead, prosecutors let him plead guilty to a lesser charge, false imprisonment.
Pleading down and getting to keep his gun. Robert, when you look at all the cases on your list, was this the only one like that?
No, I mean, roughly a third, more than a third of the cases we looked at where cops were facing pretty serious domestic violence charges that would have cost them their guns, pled down to something that at least in theory would allow the individual to keep a gun and to keep working in law enforcement.
Some of the prosecutors who made those plea deals wouldn't talk to us for this story, including the one who prosecuted Tony Canty. But then there's District Attorney Steve Wagstaff. He's been a prosecutor in San Mateo County, just south of San Francisco, for 42 years. And if every prosecutor was like Steve, we might not need that list of convicted cops. Steve says he emails the media every time he files charges against a police officer.
You know, I truly do admire law enforcement. I think that it's so crucial. But I do think, just like I think about our office, if you want to get the benefits of being a government employee, then darn it, you've got to follow the rules and you got to be willing to stand up and own every decision you make. And I've really got on my soapbox.
So in the spirit of owning every decision, I asked him, why would a prosecutor let someone who committed an act of domestic violence get away without pleading guilty to domestic violence?
Why does that happen?
And I've seen it happen. I've authorized it on occasions. And every time we've authorized it, I hate it.
He says in some cases, he did it because the victim didn't want to prosecute their abuser. But he also says prosecuting police officers is different.
It's so completely different because we teach our kids, you know, respect the blue, honor the blue, trust the blue. And now we're telling a jury, don't trust them. We're telling you they committed a crime. They have betrayed their trust. And that's hard for people. And so that's a factor that doesn't exist in our other cases. And that's a factor why you see more plea bargaining and many cases that just never get prosecuted because we just say no jury is going to convict on this.
There's another legal step that domestic violence victims can take besides criminal charges. And that's getting a restraining order. Anna Marquez got one against Tony Canty.
because I was thinking, if I don't fight for this restraining order, he's gonna keep bugging me and I'm gonna go back to him. I need the restraining order.
And normally, a domestic violence restraining order would also mean Tony would lose his guns. But Tony petitioned the judge, saying he needed to keep his guns for work, training security guards and police officers.
I remember that.
Anna's older daughter, Diana, came to the court hearings.
And I remember just straight up into my head thinking, no, he should not be able to have a gun. All the time I worried that he was going to act out on revenge.
The judge said it was hard to make sure Tony would only use his guns for work since he was self-employed. But he let him keep all six guns anyways.
That just sounds like a big leap of trust for somebody who's already violated that trust.
But it's a leap that judges make pretty often.
I mean, we found more than a dozen officers or ex-officers who a judge looked at the restraining order and said, okay, I'm going to let you keep your gun because you need it for work purposes.
Sometimes it happens in these formal court hearings, but other times it was just more of a backroom deal. In this one case in San Diego, we found a piece of paper in the court files where a restraining order and a special you can keep your guns loophole, they were literally just penciled in. We showed it to that cop's attorney, Chris Morris.
Well, you know what that shows? It shows that I was one hell of a lawyer. I don't, to be honest with you, my man, I don't recall exactly how. There was a very definite discussion about the impact of a gun restriction would have on him.
In theory, that discussion should have been a careful weighing of risks. That's the theory.
But in reality, okay, I deal in reality. When a police officer walks in, they're going to get their gun back.
When the police officers get to hold on to their guns, does that mean that they can just go back to work?
Oftentimes it does. It's up to the department. It's up to the chief.
So if a cop is charged with domestic violence and can keep his gun, he could be back on the street with a badge and a gun responding to domestic violence calls.
That's absolutely correct. There was a Kern County Sheriff's deputy who was accused of handcuffing his girlfriend and slamming her face off a doorframe. There's a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy who was accused of elder abuse after squeezing his dying father's arms hard enough to leave bloody marks. There is another Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy, Champion Boxer, who allegedly blackened his daughter's eye. All of those people I just mentioned are still working as law enforcement officers today.
And all the officers he just mentioned have something else in common, too, which is that none of their criminal convictions were reported on before.
And it seems to be a pattern. We found a dozen officers still employed despite a conviction in a domestic violence case. 10 of them appear to have never been covered in the news.
And while we can't draw a conclusion about cause and effect, in general, if you go down our list, a much higher percentage of officers kept their jobs after a criminal conviction when that conviction wasn't in the news, when the public didn't know about it.
The public has an oversight role and an oversight right, I think.
But, you know, just look at this project. The attorney general tried to shut it down. The court system made documents hard to access. There's just a shortage of local reporters. All of these things that make our jobs more difficult as reporters, they are also getting in the way of that ability for the public to hold police officers accountable. You can't do oversight of things you can't see.
That was Reveal's Stan Alcorn, with Robert Lewis of UC Berkeley's investigative reporting program, who, so far, has not been prosecuted for keeping that list of convicted current, former, and aspiring cops. And there is a searchable database of all the officers Robert and his team tracked down, plus stories from newspapers across California. To check them out, sign up for our newsletter by going to revealnews.org/newsletter. After the break, we'll dig into the story of one officer and what happens when police departments keep secrets, not just from the public, but from each other. That's next
on Reveal.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. It's May 21st, 1984, Oakland, California. Greg Lassonde is driving home from class late one night when he stops at an intersection.
And I look across, and in this vacant lot, I see a police car with the door open. And I see an officer, and I see a very large man. And I can tell there's some kind of scuffle going on.
Greg watched as the man walked towards the officer, who kept backing up.
At some point then, the officer pulled out his baton. And at that point, things unfolded more quickly.
He says the officer tripped and fell backwards over a small rise on the ground.
What happened, from my point of view, is when he tripped, he lost whatever judgment he had left and just got his revolver out and fired it.
Six shots at close range. Greg says it was a crazy moment and he felt he had to be a witness. So he parked his car and kept watching. The officer made his way to a gas station where he reloaded his gun and fired again. In total, the officer shot the man nine times, three in the abdomen, twice in the chest, once in each hand, and two bullets to the head. Greg knew the man had to be dead.
And I could tell there's nothing more that I could do, so I went back to my car and pulled away. The next day or the day after, I read a newspaper account of the story, and I was very disturbed at what I read.
An article in the Oakland Tribune identified the dead man as Jerry Stansel, a 35-year-old fry cook who'd just been fired that night. He had a history of mental illness. The police officer was Mark Ndaya. He'd been on the force only 13 months. The article quoted a police spokesman who said Stansel had grabbed the officer's baton, knocked him to the ground, and beat him repeatedly before the officer shot him.
I knew that was blatantly a lie.
Greg is convinced of what he saw that night. Other witnesses had different stories. One said he did see Stansel beat Ndaya with the baton. Another remembers seeing Stansel holding something. Regardless of the conflicting accounts, Jerry Stansel's family filed a civil rights suit against Ndaya, the police chief, and the city of Oakland. Their case was based on the fact that Stansel's fingerprints weren't found on the baton. An officer Ndaya only had minor injuries. An appellate court agreed that Ndaya had never been in serious danger and sent the case to a lower court for trial. The city offered to settle, but the family took it to a jury who ultimately ruled in favor of the police. Earlier, we heard about police officers who are convicted of a crime and stay in law enforcement. But they're not the only police being protected by a veil of secrecy. There are other officers who, despite years of serious misconduct on the job, continue to work in law enforcement. That's what happened with Mark Ndaya over the next 30 years. Nika Singh of the show Snap Judgment investigates.
Yeah, didn't actually seal the documents.
Oh, cool. Awesome, thank you.
I'm sitting in a windowless room on the 16th floor of the Northern District Courthouse in San Francisco, looking through boxes of documents with Mark Andaya's name on them. A former cop had pointed me to Andaya when he heard I was working on this story. Ndaya's court records show that while he was with the Oakland PD, there were two federal lawsuits against him for the use of excessive force and one for wrongful death. But except for a year stint in the military, he remained on the force for 9 years after shooting Jerry Stansel. He resigned in May of 1994. But he didn't go far. 4 days after resigning, he joined the San Francisco Police Department, just across the Bay Bridge. And from there, it wasn't long before he had his second deadly encounter with the suspect. On June 4th, 1995, Officer Andaya heard a police dispatch about a burglary and a black male seen running from the scene. Andaya spotted a man he knew in the area. His name was Aaron Williams. This is what Andaya said later at an internal investigation.
I identified myself as a police officer, and I said, "Hey, Aaron, I need to talk to you for a second."
Aaron didn't answer and ran to the door of a nearby apartment building.
He turned around from the door, looked directly at me, and shook his head, got buzzed in, and made sure to close the door behind him.
After Aaron appeared in an open window, Andaya says he was incoherent.
He would say something like, 1, 2, 3, 4. They started talking about something about a robbery over in the West Side Project, and then he'd say something like ABC.
Police eventually coaxed him outside, but when they tried to handcuff him, a struggle broke out. Neighbors testified as to what they saw.
I saw Aaron just walking out the front door, and 2 or 3 police officers grabbed him. There was a struggle.
And eventually, I saw a man in plain clothes kicking Mr. Williams. My memory of it was that it was 2 sets of kicking of about 4 times each. They were fast and really hard.
Aaron never got up, but he was moving. And then I believe it was the same person kicked him again in the head area about 5 times. And 2 or 3 officers grabbed the upper part of his body and dragged him further out into the street. And I remember seeing that there was blood underneath him.
According to police reports, officers cuffed Aaron, put restraints on his legs, and then put a paper mask over his face before loading him into a patrol wagon. Then, they drove him to a local police station where a supervisor became concerned and ordered CPR. A short time later, Aaron Williams was pronounced dead.
Hi.
Thank God I heard you knocking on the door.
That's Lynette Robinson. She's Aaron's aunt. She helped raise him. She lives just a few blocks from the apartment building Aaron ran into the night that he died.
Okay, you go up.
You have a beautiful house.
Oh, thank you.
The ceilings are high, and there are collectibles and paintings that celebrate the culture and history of Black Americans. There are also family photos on every wall.
Okay, this is Aaron. That's Aaron.
Aaron's photo is in a big gold frame. He's wearing a blue jean jacket and jeans, thin dark sunglasses, and his clenched fists are wrapped in black biker gloves. Aaron had a hard time growing up. From the time he was 21, he had a string of burglary and narcotics convictions.
He was in jail when my sister died, and he took it so hard. And when he got out of jail, he just tried to change his life.
Aaron joined a program to help with his addiction. He got a job at a Gatorade factory, and he got married.
He loved his family. Aaron was a good person.
But at the time of the break-in, Aaron had recently been laid off. He had his parole suspended for failure to report, and his family said he had started using drugs again. Aaron's aunt saw his body the day after he died.
We went to the morgue to go see him. And his head was all swollen. It was like a basketball when he kicked them all in his head.
The city's medical examiner report lists cause of death as heart failure due to acute cocaine abuse, with asphyxia as a possible secondary factor. Aaron's family hired their own pathologist, though. And while he agreed that cocaine was involved, he also found that the way Aaron was loaded into the police van and the blows to his body both contributed to his heart failure. It had only been 4 years since the Rodney King beating in L.A., and now Aaron had become another symbol of police abuse. He was buried on June 14th. That same day, protesters disrupted a regular meeting of the San Francisco Police Commission.
Okay, come on, take your seats at this time. Let this meeting begin or else it's...
No justice, no peace! No justice, no peace! No justice!
One of the organizers was a young civil rights attorney named Van Jones. This was years before he became a news commentator on CNN. Jones told me the protests became a regular part of the weekly police commission meetings.
Night after night, every camera crew in the Bay Area came down to see this massive, massive fight. It was pandemonium. The police officers union would, you know, turn out 20, 30, 40 of their officers. We'd show up with a couple hundred community members, and we were elbow to elbow, face to face.
Van Jones was the enemy. We didn't like Van Jones.
Carl Tenenbaum was a young cop at the time and an active member of the police officers union.
We were there in mass to defend Mark and I, and half the police commission room was full of police officers and supporters, and the other half of the room was full of Aaron Williams' family and those supporters.
This was a contest of wills between a police officers union that had decided that no matter what this officer had done, he was not going to be pushed out by community pressure, and a community that said, we're not taking it anymore.
Just a lot of vitriol being thrown back and forth.
Officers, commissioners, if you'd like to join us in a moment of silence and reconciliation.
And I just remember at one point, and I have to acknowledge that I was a part of it too, half that room of cops started chanting shame, shame, shame.
Shame, 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 shame.
And it got really loud, and it was just, in hindsight, it was really embarrassing. So as a younger cop, and I was buying into it lock, stock, and barrel.
The police commission hearings went on for 2 years. In the end, all the officers were cleared of any criminal wrongdoing. However, there was an internal police hearing, and Ndiaye was charged for excessive force, for kicking Aaron. But the only thing that stuck to him was a charge of neglect of duty, for failing to monitor Aaron's condition. The commission voted to suspend him for 90 days. But shortly after, they received a letter from a citizen. It contained troubling details of his time on the Oakland force and led to another string of hearings. This time, things worked out differently.
In closing arguments before the police commission, the police department's lawyer showed a blown-up record of the 37 complaints against Ndiaye during his 11 years on the Oakland police force. Ndiaye also failed to mention two police brutality lawsuits against him.
Mark Ndiaye was fired from the San Francisco Police Department not because of Aaron Williams' death, but for an incomplete job application.
Today, you could hear the activists cheer the commission's findings as Ndiaye made his way out of the hearing room. Aaron Williams' aunt, who raised him after his mother died, hugged her supporters.
I'm very happy what happened today. And I can go to my nephew's grave and tell him finally we got some kind of justice for him.
But let's go back a few years. Why did the San Francisco Police Department hire Mark Ndiaye in the first place?
In the interview, he was terrific.
I've gone to see Reno Rapignani, an attorney and a retired San Francisco police officer. Back in 1994, he was working as a background investigator for the department. He was in charge of reviewing Ndiaye's application.
He was well-dressed. He had that kind of bearing. He was in good shape. Did a great job on the interview.
Reno says he requested Ndiaye's personnel file from the Oakland PD, but they wouldn't give it to him. He says that wasn't uncommon. A lot of police departments wouldn't turn over personnel records, and they weren't required to.
Without the personnel file, what the hell can you do? You don't know what kind of training they have, what kind of situations they've been involved in. He did disclose there'd been an investigation into a fatality that he was involved in.
Ndiaye also told the hiring committee that he was named in a civil lawsuit resulting from that fatality, but that he'd been cleared in both cases. He also mentioned that he'd been suspended for 30 days for choking a suspect. The committee ordered Ndiaye to undergo a routine psychological profile. In their report, two psychologists warned Ndiaye was unfit to become a police officer. Reno later testified that they cited one fear.
That we could not hire this candidate because of a future incident that might cause the department to look bad.
But Ndiaye was hired anyway. Reno says the reason was San Francisco was short of cops.
Back then, in 94, we needed cops. We needed them quickly, and we wanted them already trained. And they would go through a very limited field training program, just more of an orientation.
Ndiaye applied through a lateral transfer program. That means he didn't have to go through the full police academy again. Someone like him, a cop from another department in another city, would be coming in, already trained and certified and ready to serve. It was either that or hire a new recruit who may or may not make it through the 9 months of training.
There was a real rush to get this done because we were that low. And, you know, it affects calls for service, response times. So there was a lot of political pressure on the mayor, who then gave it to the chief. And so that's how things work, you know.
So the cop shortage was one reason Mark Ndiaye was able to move from Oakland's police department to San Francisco's. But it turns out there's a bigger problem with how cops get hired in at least some of the 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country.
I think there's an incentive within that police subculture for agencies to protect their own and reject all the flags that are raised.
That's Philip Stinson. He's a former cop who's now a professor at Bowling Green State University, teaching criminal justice and researching police officers with troubling records. He's found that even when agencies do take action and hang paper on someone, that's when a cop writes a memo about another cop's bad behavior. They don't always share that information.
So the dark figure of police crime, what we don't know is that many officers who get in trouble, who are accused of various types of misconduct, are given the opportunity to quietly resign. In other words, if you resign, we're not going to charge you criminally, and you can go on your way, and that's the end of it. And we don't know those numbers because they never found their way into the courts. They never were arrested. They don't find their way into the news articles, typically.
In Oakland, at least a handful of officers came forward to hang paper on Ndiaye. I'd gotten access to many of those records. And I wanted to see what Reno Rapagnani, the former San Francisco police officer, would make of them. I showed him an inner office letter written by Ndiaye's former captain in Oakland, a kind of greatest hits of Ndiaye's troubling behavior in his first few years with that department.
While on the recruit academy, Ndiaye pointed an unloaded handgun at his head and pulled the trigger several times. Wow. Ndiaye also was observed physically abusing a mildly uncooperative handcuffed suspect by choking him around the throat with his hands and pushing him to the ground while Ndiaye screamed, "I'll kill you." He also was very quick to put his hands on people and became physical with them. Yeah. Ndiaye tells suspects, "I've killed before and I want and will kill again." I would make the following recommendations in response to this situation. Officer Ndiaye be immediately reassigned to an administrative assignment which will limit his contact with the public and not require his carrying or use of firearms or other weapons. This is from a captain. Captain of police. I mean, this is something you would write if you're trying to terminate somebody.
The Oakland PD sent none of this information to Reno when he was considering whether or not to hire Ndiaye. After he's fired by the San Francisco police, Mark Ndiaye seems to disappear from the record. 9 years go by. But then he appears again. I find him in a database. He's working in Contra Costa, a county less than 30 miles from San Francisco. I went to see Aaron Williams' aunt to tell her the news.
So in 2006, Ndiaye was rehired by the Contra Costa Sheriff's Department.
I didn't know that. I didn't know where he I went to. And we need policemen. But Mark Ndiaye was one of them, that he should be working nowhere that has anything to do with a gun. It's because life doesn't mean anything to him. He's a killer. He's a murderer. And I said it when he killed my nephew, and I'm saying it right now. That's how I feel about him.
While I was reporting this story, I reached out to Mark Ndiaye several times. I also requested an interview with his boss, the sheriff of Contra Costa. Both declined to speak with me. As we go to air, Ndiaye is still a law enforcement officer with a badge and a gun.
That story came to us from Nika Singh of the radio show and podcast Snap Judgment. The biggest defenders of Mark Andaya came from the rank and file of the local police union. I talked to the president of the National Fraternal Order of Police about why unions continue to back officers accused of serious misconduct.
We've gone, just in a short period of time, from public servants to public enemies because the full story is not being told.
That's next on Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. When a police officer is accused of corruption or brutality or killing a member of the public, you're likely to hear from the local police union. After NYPD officer Daniel Pantaleo was fired for using a banned chokehold that a medical examiner said led to the death of Eric Gardner, the head of the local police union held a press conference.
Today's a sad day for the NYPD. When justice has not been served, the leadership of this city and this police department is absolutely afraid of the criminal advocates and based this decision not on the facts, but based this decision on the politics.
More than any other industry, a lot of police unions have had a long-term focus on protecting members accused of misconduct. They've supported laws that kept disciplinary records secret. They've negotiated contracts that ban civilian oversight, limit investigations, and destroy disciplinary records after a time. They've appealed the firing of officers who have been disciplined and gotten them rehired. Now, every police force, every police union is different. But the National Fraternal Order of Police is an umbrella group that includes many police unions. It has nearly 350,000 members and more than 2,000 local chapters. In August, they elected a new president, Patrick Yost. His first press release was a statement on the firing of Officer Pantaleo in New York. It said it was the wrong decision, that he was fired for doing his job, and that it would have a chilling effect on police across the country. I spoke with Patrick Yost 3 weeks later. In some of your campaign flyers, it said that this is one of the most turbulent times in the history of the union. What do you think is turbulent about this time that we're in right now?
Well, I think it's our profession. The world's changing. Our profession's changing with it. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of misunderstandings or a quick rush to judgment on things involving law enforcement that don't tell the full story. And I think because of that, it's creating an atmosphere where we've gone, just in a short period of time, from public servants to public enemies because the full story is not being told. But I also recognize that these changing times mean as an organization and as a profession, we need to change as well. We're allowed to do some pretty profound things as law enforcement officers and the role that we play, but that doesn't come without public trust.
I hear what you're saying. But also, you know, the one press release that you've put out since becoming president of the union was saying that it was wrong to fire the officer in the Eric Gardner case. In the death of Eric Gardner, the police officer used a chokehold that had been banned by the NYC Police Department. It took 5 years for him to be let go from the police department. And then your organization said that it was wrong for him to be fired.
All right. So if I could break that down in a few ways. Okay. So our argument and a position that we took from the organization is that both federal and state agencies fully investigated this and found that there were no violations of law. If there were, he would have been charged. 5 years later, to come back and administratively decide that wasn't good enough, we don't agree with it, that sends a message to law enforcement officers all across this country. An officer who is disciplined because of actions that he's taken, he has a right to due process. Just because we pin on a badge, we do have to be held at a higher set of standards. I totally agree with that. But just because we pin on a badge doesn't mean that we are second-class citizens.
I totally hear what you're saying about due process. My point is that the officer in the Eric Gardner case got more due process than most people get. And he was found at the end of that due process that he should not have used that chokehold, and therefore he should be let go from the police department. He wasn't locked up for it. He was literally told that he did not do the job the way he was supposed to do the job. And I would also say that, like, those officers surrounding Eric Gardner, none of them were in danger of their lives. None of them were.
Okay. I mean, that is a perception. We know how this one turned out. I could sit here for hours and tell you about situations where officers are now names on a wall, and their families don't have their officer anymore because of situations that escalated just as this one did. So I don't say that to minimize what you're saying. Mm-hmm. What I am saying is this is a very difficult job. It's very dangerous. It's not a perfect world. There's always going to be these things, but there are actions taken by everybody that escalate them. I will tell you that I think clearly every city, every agency needs to put great emphasis on training of law enforcement officers in order to de-escalate, because this is going to be a growing problem. It's not going to go away overnight, and it's going to be something that we need to equip our officers to be better prepared to deal with.
Historically, police unions across the country have generally fought to keep things like officers' disciplinary records more secret rather than pushing for more openness. It seems to me that if police unions were willing to give a little bit on that, it might gain more public trust. Why so secretive?
I don't know if I'd necessarily call it secretive. Let's apply it to any other profession. Any other profession, you have employees that have certain benefits, certain expectations, and you know, discipline is an accusation. It's not necessarily something that's founded. There's a process that it goes through. Those processes are very well detailed, and releasing information in partial is not telling the full story.
But if one of those complaints were made, it was investigated, and found that the officer did do something wrong and they were disciplined for it, shouldn't the public know about that?
I think the public certainly has a right to know, to balance the public trust with the officer's personnel rights. And I think those balances need to be made and determined by the people within those given states.
When it comes to officers who are off duty, should law enforcement officers be held to a higher standard than the general public?
I agree that law enforcement officers have to maintain public trust, and because of that, then yes, we do. We have to be at a higher standard.
So if you're convicted for a domestic violence misdemeanor today, under federal law, you can't carry a gun, which makes it hard to be a police officer. But back in the 90s, the Fraternal Order of Police was against the law. Your organization and other police unions pushed for exceptions for cops, so they would be able to carry a gun even if they had a domestic violence conviction. What's your position on that today?
I know vaguely of what you're referring to. You had a provision that determined that if you were convicted of domestic violence, you were not allowed to carry a weapon. But let's back up. Officers who were involved in situations made the decision that they were going to plead guilty to put something behind them. Had they known that that would affect them in their job and their ability to continue to be a police officer, they may have taken a different path. They may have gone to trial and decided not to just plead guilty. So that was the position that our organization took.
What's your position today, though?
The position today is that I think that we have a process that processes to evaluate and determine the actions. And if the actions are determined that an agency feels that it erodes the public trust, then that agency is going to follow the due process that they have within their state systems. And that will work itself out.
We know, though, that domestic abusers, you know, when they get a hold of guns, tend to use those guns. If someone is resorting to violence to resolve conflict in their own home, why should we trust them to carry a badge and a gun and resolve conflicts out on the streets?
Well, I think if we're talking in general terms. In general terms, I think that should not be the case. We're not condoning that someone who should not be in a uniform and carry a gun should be doing so. Our argument is that an officer has a right to due process just like anyone else.
Patrick Yost, thank you so much for sitting down and talking to me today.
You got it. Thank you, man.
Since our interview, Patrick Yost has put out a lot of statements. One, defending an officer in Virginia who'd been suspended by the police chief for calling Immigration and Customs Enforcement to the scene of a car accident to arrest one of the drivers. He put out another one in the case of Dallas officer Amber Geiger after she'd been found guilty of murdering her neighbor in his own apartment. The statement attacked the prosecutor, who said it was wrong for the head of the local police union to come to the scene of the crime and ask the officer to turn off the dash cam in the car where Officer Geiger was being held. And then there was the release that wasn't about police officers at all. It attacked unnamed members of Congress for, quote, violating due process to score political points. It said the Fraternal Order of Police exists in part to defend due process rights. And I'm quoting here, not just for police officers, but for all citizens at every level, from the indigent living on the street to the president living in the White House. Our lead producer for this week's show is Stan Alcorn. The editor is Deborah George. Thanks to all the journalists who helped out on the story of the secret list of criminal cops, especially David DeBalt, Jason Palladino, Jesse Marks, Katie Stiegel, Mike Frankel, and John Temple. And thanks to Jennifer Kahn, Mary Kay Magstad, Peter Aldous, and Tom Peel from UC Berkeley School of Journalism and their investigative reporting program for help with Nika Singh's story. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa. Original score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Amy Mustafa, Najib Amini, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our CEO is Krista Scharf from Berg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledson, and remember, there is always more to the story.